18th of December after the meetings at Miami Beach.
Mm-hmm.
This is a second interview, continuation of interview with Huey Red Alexander. I'm at his home in Palm Harbor. Palm Harbor. I want to move you real quick, like
that's
Red.
Right.
Palm Harbor, Florida. The date is Tuesday, January the 28th, 1992. Red, we left off, if I remember correctly, 2 months ago when you were with the Go-Go White Sox, or at least the beginning of that great team in the mid-1950s that later went to the World Series. But before that happened, you were off to Dodgerland in about 1956 through 1970.
That's right.
And, of course...
Yeah, when I was with the White Sox over there, Dan, we had a good club over there. Paul Richard was the manager, and Frank Lane was the general manager. It was owned by Mrs. Comiskey. And we had a good club for 4 years in a row, but we finished second each year behind the Yankees.
That's right. And unfortunately, in that, when people write about baseball and that, they only talk about the Yankees.
It's pretty good to talk about it that way.
Well,
if
yeah,
you go back over
yeah,
their record.
Darn right. You know, you look at their record, you can't deny that. But when you look at the Cleveland teams with their great pitching core and excellent defense, sometimes, not sometimes, it really was just overshadowed with what other kind of teams were going on in Major League Baseball.
I remember one of the great statements one time years ago, and I know you know about this and you've heard it. The word got out back in the 50s and 40s and 50s and about break up the Yankees. It was just a little
the
chant.
Damn Yankees.
You know, break up the damn Yankees and all that. I remember Gabe Paul come back with a rebuttal statement I thought was real good. He said, I don't care about breaking up the Yankees. He said, that's when he was president and general manager of the Cleveland Indians.
Mm-hmm.
He said, every time the Yankees come into Cleveland, we have 75,000 people each game to watch them play.
Mm-hmm.
So fine and dandy, right?
In the days before TV revenues.
Right.
That's right. That was the bread and butter. So,
sure.
You went over to Brooklyn the last year they were in Brooklyn.
2 years. They were in 56 and 57. They went to Los Angeles then.
In 58 then.
In 58.
Oh, okay. And, of course, they had just come away with their first World Series in 1955.
55, that's true.
And beating the Yankees. And
got beaten the World Series in 56, the seventh game.
That's right, uh-huh. And some great games in those days. I think Sandy Koufax had just come up to the Brooklyn organization
sure
at that
had.
Time.
Sure had. And then the funny part about it, not the, but the ironic thing about it is, then we go. They went to the coast then in 58 mm-hmm. and didn't do very good first year in Los
yeah.
Angeles. And then won the World Series in 59.
Against the White Sox.
Against the White Sox.
Sox
sure
right.
did.
Point, let's say, let's go up to the mid-60s.
Great 60, years.
65, they played Minnesota Twins, a power-hitting club. And were gained down 2-2, or to zilch, and came back and won the World
sure
Series,
sure
if
did.
I remember correctly.
Sure did.
But during that time, you also, and I'm going to say, I'm going to attribute it to you, that you assembled an incredible, well, it's never happened before in baseball, and assembled an infield that stayed together
well,
for
I
the long...
Well, I didn't do it all together myself, but...
well, tell me about, we're talking
Jordan
about Ron
myself.
Say... Yeah, Steve Garvey, Bill Russell, and Davey Lopes.
Well, three of those four, Burt Wells and I and John Keenan, who was a young scout, and Monty Baskill, who was scouting them later on coach, put together Billy Russell, Lopes, and Garvey.
Mm-hmm.
That's the three we put on that ball club. I didn't have anything to do with Ron Sick because he came from way up in the northwest part of the United States,
mm-hmm.
Washington, Oregon, somewhere up there. But those other three were from Kansas and... Even Davy Lopes now, he played at Washburn University
in Topeka, Kansas,
but he was from Rhode Island.
Uh-huh.
But he came down there to play football, and then, of course, one of our scouts saw him, Bert mm-hmm. Wells, and I went in and saw him and signed him. And then Garvey was a real good football player at what was it, Michigan State, wasn't it? But he also played baseball. He's from Tampa right over here. And Steve Garvey could not throw the ball very good. He couldn't catch the ball very good. Steve Garvey could do two things. Steve Garvey could swing the bat, and he mm-hmm. could run. And Burt Wells and I went to see him play, and Monty Basco was worried about signing him, and Guy Wellman, the two scouts up in that part of the country, of the fact that he was going to cost about $40,000 bonus,
mm-hmm.
and he might not be worth it because of his ability to catch the ball and throw it.
But he won four golden gloves.
Right. But at first
not
base,
at
but in the, when he was playing, he was a third base.
Oh, that's right. He started out at third
right.
base.
So we pushed the thing and talked Al Campanis and Buzzy Bavazian and letting those guys give him $40,000.
Mm-hmm.
And because he became a good player. But mm-hmm. They were worried about it, and Bert and I worried a little bit about it, but not a great lot. I remember Bert and I used to say, let's go ahead and do it anyway. Let's gamble of the fact that they might fire one of us. I don't believe they'll fire both of us.
he turned out to be an excellent clutch hitter.
He sure did. He sure did.
And I think he...
You know, when I was advanced scouting for the Phillies all those years, I finally, not that I was trying to be so smart or intelligent, but I finally figured that Garvey out. And we did a little better with him later on. To this extent, then, when he was ahead in the count, I watched him game after game after game, time after time at bat. Mm-hmm. And when he was ahead in the count, he would pull the ball. And when he was behind in the count, he would go to the opposite field. And we pegged that thing pretty good, and we had Daniel Ozark and all of us tried it on him.
Mm-hmm.
And we had better results with him from picking up that little deal, like you were talking about mm-hmm. earlier about ballplayers stealing signs from
yeah.
the pitchers and catchers. And we kind of figured Garvey out on that day. We did the same thing one time with San Guillen at Pittsburgh. We were having a hard time getting San Guillen out because
mm-hmm.
he used to pull the ball on us to left mm-hmm. field all the time. So one day I suggested to Paul Owens and Dallas Green and Daniel Ozark, or whoever might have been the manager then, I said, why don't we do this? Why don't we pitch him outside and make him hit the ball to right field and play him over there? Just make him hit the ball mm-hmm. to right field. If we pitch him outside, he wants to pull the ball. He can't hit home runs anyway
yeah.
if it's the ball's outside. Let's make him go to right field, and we'll play him over there. And we had a lot better luck with him after that.
Mm-hmm.
We just made him go to right field with the ball.
Steve Garvey, I think, played in about 1,200 consecutive games.
Played in a bunch of them. Yeah. I think you're probably right there, close to that.
Until he broke his thumb, and
right.
then that, which, you know, today we're all looking at the headlines in a few years with Carl Ripken Jr. Now must be what? He's past 1,200 games, I'm sure. I think he could.
He's way up there.
He's way up there now, and probably second on the list now.
He's second on the list, right? I think he's, what, 14 or 1,500?
Yeah, I think so.
Somewhere
yeah, close
area.
To it. And one of those...
A writer called me the other day. He was going to write a story about Ripken versus...
Lou Gehrig?
No, Smith. Ozzie Smith with the Cardinals.
Oh, okay.
Shortstop?
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, you can't do it. There's no way you can compare those two ballplayers. I said, Ozzie Smith is one of the greatest infielders, shortstops of all times, defense.
Mm-hmm.
And Ripken is one of the great shortstops offense, so you can't really compare those. I mean, it would be tough to say which one would be the best. And that's the way I ended it up in the conversation with him on the phone was that if you've got a good club and you need a good fielding shortstop, you better go get Ozzie Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got, you know, lack some hitting on your ball club, you better go try to get Ripken. And then the writer said, well, he thinks that's a good idea. That's where I write it, but I don't think you could compare those two players,
no,
do you?
No. You know, Ripken, you know, he's a big guy.
He's big.
And you don't find many big guys playing.
And he plays a good shortstop.
Plays second or short. You know, they're usually
right.
wiry like Ozzie Smith.
Right.
But to get a big guy like Ripken,
he's
about
6'2",
6'3".
Yeah, he's learned to play the hitters.
Yeah. So,
he weighs over 200 pounds.
Yeah.
And he's an offensive player, but he's a pretty good shortstop.
Yes.
But Ozzie Smith's a great shortstop.
Yeah.
You know, he does
yeah.
things out of this world.
Yeah.
He's slowing up some now, but he's
been around the block a long time, too.
He has that.
You signed Davey Lopes. He was out in Washburn University. He played on a champion collegiate team in baseball. And you were scouting out in the Midwest, Oklahoma, and looking at Johnny Bench and those kinds of guys, including Bill Russell. What'd you see in Davey Lopes that said, hey, we got to get him?
Well, when Bert Wells and I went to see Davy Lopes play at Washburn University, because we had a real young scout that saw him, and he liked some of the things he did. And then the coach, and I can't think of his name right now, it's been so many years ago, the coach of Washburn University was a part-time scout for the Dodgers. He was a part-time scout, had been for several years, mm-hmm. what we call an associate scout, not a bird dog, I don't like the name, bird dog scout. And he kept pushing Davy Lopes. Davy Lopes was a center fielder in college. He played center field. And Bert Wells now passed on him and gave the okay, then John Keenan and Monty Baskel signed him. And we sent him out in professional baseball, and he played center field. That fall, Monty Baskel in the instructional league made him into a second baseman. In one fall in the instructional league, made him into a second baseman. And I am not finished. After that, we signed Billy Russell, who was a center fielder in high school, Pittsburgh, Kansas. He went to Ogden, Utah with Tom Lasorda, who was the manager. And he couldn't hit very much. Mm-hmm. In fact, he hit about 175 in that rookie league.
Yeah.
That fall, Monty Baskel took him in hand and made him a shortstop. And those are true stories right there, two of them.
Well, didn't Walt Austin feel that Bill Russell was even a better outfielder than Willie Mays?
That's what he said one time. Billy Russell could...
Why'd they put him on the infield then?
Because he wasn't going to hit enough. Billy Russell, you mean?
Yeah.
He just wasn't going to hit enough. Later on, he became a decent hitter. But if you go way back and look up his record, he didn't hit very good. He didn't hit very good mm-hmm. early. Then later on, he got older and he got a lot smarter, mm-hmm. more intelligent, and he became a pretty decent hitter like Marty Marion did years ago with the Cardinals.
Yeah.
But he just wasn't going to hit enough to play that outfield. Because, you know, outfielders are supposed to hit. And,
yeah, that's
and
right.
Lopes
that's
was the concept. Same way. They just didn't think that he was going to hit enough to play center field. And plus the fact they needed a second baseman real bad. So that, and then later on they knew that Maury Wills was going to be finished.
That's right, he was retiring.
And that left Russell. But Russell could run and Lopes could run. And they had good arms. And they had good hands. They just didn't hit very much. And then later on both of them became... You remember one year, Davy Lopes leading off, hit about 20 home runs leading off one year.
Yeah.
So it's just things that you come across that you decide, well, we're going to do this. But the emphasis on this was both of them were center fielders in college and high school.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you looked at them, of course, you don't know when they're going to come up to the majors and what's the rest of the team, what are the needs of the team, outfielders, second base, what have you. But... when you scouted these guys, did you think of them simply having great potential and good performance?
Here's the way we used to do, Dan.
And not worry about position?
Here's what we used to do, and I'll answer your question. We went on tools, what we call tools. We used to sign an awful lot of ballers.
T-O-O-L-S?
T-O-O-L-S, tools. That's ability, that's... being able to throw the ball, uh-huh. speed, field. What we used to do on a regular player, not pitchers, you know, on regular players, we called it tools.
Uh-huh.
If he could run, throw, and field, those three things, we would sign that ball player.
And didn't worry about position.
And we didn't worry about the hitting because he had enough ability to survive. Don Demeter is one of the best examples I know of. When Bert Wells and I saw him in high school, we were trying to sign a shortstop and a second baseman off the high school team in Oklahoma City, mm-hmm. Capitol Hill High School, who had great ball clubs. And the coach worked for the Dodgers. He was a part-time scout. We had a bunch of them. So we're getting ready to sign the two players. One was named Davis, and the other one was named Davidson. And neither one of them ever got to the big leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And we're really bearing down trying to sign those two ball players. And they were good friends, and we're in one of the homes. And both parents are there, both sets of parents. And right at the last minute, both ball players and the parents said, we will sign if you will sign Don Demeter, our center fielder. And Bert Wells and I did not want to sign Don Demeter. because Don Demeter couldn't hit a baseball if it's big as a basketball. He was a terrible hitter. I mean, he was a terrible-looking hitter, big, tall, rangy kid. But he could run, throw, and catch the ball in center field. He really could. So as a last resort, that night late, Burt Wells and I had a little conference outside of the house. We went back in. We decided after, okay, we'll sign Don Demeter because he was going to cost $1,000 at all. The other two ballplayers were going to cost more than that. So to get the other two ballplayers, we agreed among ourselves we would sign Don Demeter. Well, Don Demeter went to big leagues and hit 200-some home runs in the big league. Mm-hmm. We sent Don Demeter to Shawnee, Oklahoma, which was about 38 miles from Oklahoma City. And he set a record in the Sooner State League in strikeouts. He struck out about 190 times the rest of the year. But he had ability. He really had some, he could run, throw, and catch the ball. The next year they sent him to the California State League. I think it was Bakersfield or one of those cities out there. And he set a record in strikeouts, over 200 strikeouts in one season. And the next year they sent him to Pueblo, Colorado. And he was struggling all at that time, hit about 150, 160, 170. Sent him to Pueblo in the Western League, Class A League. And again, he broke the record in strikeouts. The next year, he was in Fort Worth, Texas, in the Texas League, and hit 41 home runs and went to the big leagues. It took him 4 years to finally put it together. Okay, what I tell scouts today, that's where the scouting changed. You can't sign that ball player today. You can't sign him.
You're not going to take that much time with him.
No, because the next year he'll get released. Mm-hmm. The very next year he'll get released because when that draft comes up, you sign him this June, right, mm-hmm. in 92. And you know he can't hit. And he goes out and he hits about 140 or 160. Terrible-looking hitter, right? Mm-hmm. The next June of 93, when they draft a bunch of ball players and sign him, somebody will take his place. So when I'm teaching the scouts now or talking to scouts about what my philosophy is about scouting, be careful of the ball player who can run, throw, and field and can't hit because he'll get released in 1 year. It used to be when we used to have six Class D ball clubs, six, like the Dodgers. Yeah. We had six Class D ball clubs. You couldn't go any lower. And we put Don Demeter on one of those clubs, and he can't make that club. We just shift him to another Class D club.
That's right.
And if he can't do any good there, we put him to another one. We've got six clubs. One of those clubs you're going to be able to play on. So he'll survive. Today he won't survive.
Well, would you say the same thing, let's say, when you were with the Phillies? I guess about 73, 74, that Mike Schmidt came up. It looked terrible. He batted, 193 the first year?
He hit 190. He hit 190.
And he would have been thrown
out all the time.
Yeah, that's right. And he'd been thrown out.
He sure would have.
He's going to be in the Hall of Fame in about 3 years.
It won't take very long. When he's eligible, he'd go right in the Hall of Fame.
Right.
He had 500 and some home runs. But he struggled. He really struggled.
That's right. And Danny Ozark and you worked with him.
Sure did.
Tried to beat advice in his head, right. And he wouldn't take it.
That's right, because he was a little on the hard-headed side. But again, that's what we're talking about right there. So the scouts that are successful today, and it's not individual scouting, make your name today because the draft takes care of all that. Mm-hmm. But you got to be careful. And some of my good friends who are young scouts that I like and kind of brought along, I tell them, be careful. Be careful. I don't want you to be anti. You've got to sign ball player. But be careful on the guy that can't hit the ball. If he can't hit that ball, it's going to take him some time to learn to adjust a little bit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's not enough time. He'll get released in a year or so.
Yeah.
And it happens. It happens every year.
That's right.
That's what one of my big talks in baseball with different clubs today, just sitting around wherever we are, is if we could cut down on the mistakes, just cut down on the mistakes that are made in signing ball players, we could save millions of dollars. I'm talking about millions. I'm not talking about hundreds of thousands. I'm talking about millions of the fact we're signing 1,000, 1,200 ballplayers a year,
mm-hmm.
amateur ballplayers, maybe 1,400, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they can't be that many bona fide prospects. They really can't be that many. So what they're doing is saying, well, this ballplayer can run, he's a shortstop, or whatever he might play, mm-hmm. the way he plays, and he's got some ability, but if he doesn't hit, he'll get released. And then it's a detriment then to the young ball player because maybe he had a chance out of high school to go get a scholarship in college. So I think the best procedure today, and I voice my opinion real strong on this, Dan, is be careful on the high school ball player. Be careful. Even back in my days when I was scouting 30, 40, 50 years ago as a free agent scout, I was a little careful then on high school ball player because the fatality rate is real high, real high. The thing that's really helped baseball is the college programs they have today. They've really got some good college programs, and you know, living in Fort Lauderdale, you know what the University of Miami does, Florida State, Florida University, Southern California, Texas, all the warm climate have good baseball programs, real good.
Yeah.
And they're playing 60, 70 ball games a year. And I don't know whether you and I touched on this on the last interview or not, or the last taping thing we did. If you take a freshman who can play ball now in college, right? Way back in the old days, you couldn't play as a freshman. Play a sophomore.
Yeah, ineligible.
Right. You take a high school boy today who can play ball pretty good and put him in a Miami University or one of the warm climates, and he'll play, they've got him limited now to 60 games. That's an awful lot of games. Let's go back to September. Let's go back to this past September. You've got a son that's playing ball at Miami University, a freshman. He's going to play 30 games this past September and October. He's going to play 30 in the fall. And here comes him as a freshman in the spring. He's going to play 60. Now he's played 90 ball games. He's played close to 100 ball games, hasn't he? Now he goes to the Cape Cod League, or he goes to Alaska, or he goes to Kansas, the Jayhawk League, the Summer Pro League, and he plays another 50 games. So now as a freshman, he's played 150 ball games, hasn't he?
Yeah.
He does the same thing as a sophomore. Now he's played 300, right? Now he becomes a junior, and he plays 30 and maybe 60, and then he's signed. And he has played 390 baseball games in college and summer pro. Now he's ready to go play ball. Where that high school boy, he plays 10 or 15 or 20 games as a senior, and then he's going to go out in professional baseball, and he gets overmatched. He gets overmatched. And I feel sorry for him. So, again, it's treacherous. And that's the way I teach or try to teach scouting nowadays. And don't be a negative scout, but just be sure this guy can swing the bat a little bit. Otherwise, he'll get released.
And, of course, the old saw that there are a lot of fantastic ball players, but they couldn't hit a curveball.
Well, the curveball's hard to hit. I've never known very many. You know, we talk about this an awful lot, some of the old guys like your friend Steve Suchak and a lot of us old baseball guys that are up in the 70s or so on. So we've been in baseball 50-some years. We talk about it. I can't name you, maybe outside of Roger Hornsby and three or four or five, that could hit a curve. I don't think anybody can hit a real good curve. I'm talking about a real good one. I don't think anybody can hit one. Because it's just not, you're not a Superman. That curveball is a tough pitch to hit.
Yeah.
But the pitcher, it can't throw curveballs all the time. He's got to throw fastballs and sliders. So the hitters, that's right. And a lot of hitters today, especially hitters today, they set right on that fastball. And if the guy throws them three curves, they go to the bench and sit down. They just struck out, right?
Yeah,
but if they get a fastball, look out. Look out.
As you look at scouting today, and you're saying the difference between what it is in 1992 compared to even 20 years ago. Example, Schmidt, Mike Schmidt.
That's a good example. Real good.
Just 20 years ago when he came up to the major leagues, and I think that first year the press was all over you and Danny Ozark, get rid of this guy. What in the Sam Hill you put in a major leaguer that's batting 190 at third base?
We'll give you another good example. When I was working with the Phillies, John Stearns was the number one draft in the United States, and the Phillies had the number one draft. They took him, gave him $75,000 bonus, and I had seen John Stearns play at college at Colorado University. Dallas Green and I went to see him play a weekend series. And in the signing, he wanted to start in double A ball, like Mike Schmidt. John Stearns said, I can play ball at Reading, Pennsylvania, in the Eastern League. And we kept saying, no, you can't. You cannot. That's too tough a league. You'll get overmatched in the league. And, of course, you know, he'd had the great years in college. And, I can play. No, we want you to go over in the Carolina League and start over there. No, I'll sign if I can play in the Eastern League at Reading, Pennsylvania. So as a last resort, we had to say yes, right? We didn't have any choice. Okay?
Yeah.
You go to Reading. Mm-hmm. But you're going to go to Reading. Now, if you can't handle the pitching in the Eastern League, then you're at our mercy, so to speak. You're going to have to go over in the Carolina League. Okay, I'll do that because I can play at Reading. Mm-hmm. But he couldn't. He had 170. After about a month, so we said, okay, we're going to send you now to the Carolina League, which he didn't have any choice in. But again, those things hurt. So just imagine, I used to tell general managers and owners and people, that say, our scout just signed that ball player out of high school, and look at him. He can't really play ball too good. Mm-hmm. And I used to tell Rudy Carpenter, especially over at the Phillies, you know.
Yeah.
I said, Rudy, listen, the boy is 17 or 18 years old. This is the first time he's ever been away from home in his life. He left his mother and dad, his brother and his sisters, if he have any, his girlfriends, all of his friends in the little town. He's 1,000 miles from home. He never made a living before in his life. Give the boy a chance. Give him a chance to get his feet on the ground. Don't make a hasty decision on this ball player. This ball player's got a little ability, and see if he can put it all together. But it's tough. It really is.
You say one of the first conversation that the easiest thing to say in scouting is to say no.
That's the easiest thing there is to do, is say no. You'll be right about 95% of the time.
And
if you're talking about big league players.
That's right.
And every ball player you sign should have a chance to play in the big league.
Yeah.
If you sign ball players knowing that he can't play in the big leagues, then you're going to waste money and time.
Mm-hmm.
So the easy thing is to say no.
Yeah.
And a lot of scouts, some scouts, took that philosophy years ago. They'd say, if I say no every time, I'm going to be right. And if I make good reports, then I'll last a long time. Well, some of them did. But my theory on this, so let's say it's 95% time you're right, okay?
Yeah.
What about that other 5%? You're going to pass up a Willie Mays, pass up some of the great ball players, just out of that 5%, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
So now you'll really be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So it would work up to a point, but then you'll lose the great player.
Okay. It's easy to identify, and let's go back to when you were with the Dodgers momentarily, from 1956, I think, until 1970.
Right.
And the rebuilding of that Dodger organization to really occurred then, that is reflects what it is today.
Well, that's what I had. You remember
the farming, the farm system. You had Drysdale come up. You had
Koufax.
You had Gillian, Junior Gillian.
Jackie Robinson, Duke Snyder, yeah. Carl Ferrello, Roy Campanella, Gil Hodges. Well, one of the reasons for that, Dan, is way back in those days, and that's not 50 years ago. That's back.
We were talking about 25 years ago.
Right. You got to remember the Dodgers and the Cardinals and the Yankees, those three ball clubs, and there was two or three others. But those ball clubs in particular, they had 25, 26 farm clubs. Clubs today, we only have 5 or 6 farm clubs. So what it is, we can't wholesale sign players. You can't do it because you just sign too many. You'd have too many ball players. But back in one spring, and I might have said this in the last interview, I'm not sure, but I'll just repeat it real quick if I did. One spring in Vero Beach, I was down there, and we had 705 ball players in camp. 705. You know what a club goes to spring training today with minor league players? About 140 to maybe 150. So where's that other 450 players or 500 players? See, they're home.
Yeah, they're not playing.
They're not playing. So we've made some mistakes, but you got to remember, the ball player back in the days I'm talking about would cost you $1,000 bonus, or $5,000, or $4,000, or sometimes $100, or sometimes $500. That same ball player today is costing you $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 bonus. Same identical player. So you can't sign wholesale sign them, because you'd run out of money.
You think of Dick Allen, who played with the Phillies in the mid-70s, and, well, he was traded all over the place. Would find a niche and be signed up today. You know, raw ability. I mean, incredible body.
Hey, he'd be signed because he could do two things all his career he played. Well, he could do three. He could throw. He had a good arm. He could run, you remember.
Yeah.
And he could swing the bat. Don't make it how crude he was. he could swing the bat. The ball would jump off of that bat. Today, and I've said this now for the last 10 years to different young scouts and baseball people, the ball player that goes to the big leagues today in the last 10 years is the ball player who can run, who has speed, and can swing the bat. That's the ball player that gets the big leagues, and he'll get there quick. He'll get there real quick. And you'll say to yourself, well, where's he going to play? And I'll say, Dan, I don't know where he's going to play, but he's going to play some position because he can do those two things. And the big, tough ball player today, that's what he can do. He can run, and he can swing the bat. Now, if he can only swing the bat, he might be a fatality. Because if he goes out in pro ball and he doesn't hit real quick as a youngster, then he gets released because he doesn't have anything to fall back on. He doesn't have a good arm, and he doesn't have any speed.
But you overlook, or you have said nothing about what I call attitude. Now, I'm not saying you can find it by looking in somebody's eyes.
It's hard to do it. You can't cut them open.
I can't. I'm no better a mind reader, and I've hired a lot of people in my line of work, and some of them have paid dividends, some haven't.
Right.
Because you can't do it in one interview, and you certainly can't do it by just going out to the field and watching guys five or six times.
One of my big statements and one of my theories has been all over the years is this ball player, if you let me see this ball player two or three games, I don't like the idea of seeing a ball player play one ball game because he might not even have a chance. And plus the fact he might get walked twice one game not enough. You let me see a ball player play two or three ball games, and I'll tell you, not that I'm trying to brag, I'll tell you if this ball player has enough ability to play in the big leagues in the future. I can tell you that.
Uh-huh.
If you let me see him play, I don't care what position he plays. But the thing I used to say, I'd call up and I'd say, okay, I've just found a ball player, Dan Austin, so-and-so, and what, you know, give a rundown on him, break him down. And my last statement used to be this, but there's one thing I can't do because it's against the law. I can't take a knife and cut him open to see what he's made of inside. I can't do that. It's against the law.
Yeah.
And it's true. I can't do it. I can't cut his head open. Well, I can't cut his belly open. I don't know.
Can you do it this way? Looking at the fundamentals of the way they play the game, and if the manager or the coach on that team that you're scouting is trying to teach those guys fundamentals. I'll give you an example. Playoff game, I think with Atlanta Braves, Lonnie Smith, I think.
That was the World Series.
No, I think it was the playoffs.
Okay, go ahead.
When they won the playoffs, they may have been the World Series, where the bases were loaded. Lonnie Smith, I think, was up to bat.
Oh, that's different.
It was the playoffs. Pitcher threw a fast inside-er. I mean, it was really, he would have been hit, and he jumps back. Now, damn it, why did he do that? The baseball wasn't going to kill him and get hit, and they would have won the game.
Well,
you and I both.
Now,
you and I
in
both.
My book, if I were the manager, I would have fined his ass.
Well, probably so, but again, the ball player today.
Maybe I'm old-fashioned.
A little bit, and so am I. But if you take the ball player today and you're up at plate and you're making $4 million a year or you're making $2 million, but you're one of the millionaire ball players, you're not going to get hit with that ball.
If I want to win the ball game, I will.
I'm not sure you will. You would then because...
I'll get a bruise.
Yeah, but if you got hurt, you've lost a lot of money. And the ball players today think that way. Not totally, but they do think about that. They're not going to take a lot of unnecessary chances. Because they got a big career ahead of them where they're going to make $20 million in a career, or 10 or 15 or 20, or maybe $50 million in a career, right? And they're not going to take that big chance. And in one sense of the word, maybe you can't blame them.
Well, I guess so. We talked that, I'll never.
The one sport that I see where it doesn't seem to really make a lot of difference in the money they make is professional basketball. Those guys really play hard.
Yeah, of course, they got a salary cap, unlike baseball.
But they play hard.
Yeah.
If they get hurt, it's their own. I mean, they take it for granted because they have no pads on. They're out there, and they play hard. When they go up for that ball on that basketball, they are rough.
That's right.
They're rough players. Now, I know about hockey because of the fact they're all padded up in football. But those basketball players, they're almost naked out there.
That's right.
And they play hard.
It's a tougher game than football.
It's a tough game. It's a tough game. And baseball's tough. When you slide, you extend the chance every time you slide to break a leg. Every time you slide.
I know. I still got a bad scar diving after a baseball before Thanksgiving.
And you can, too.
Sure, I know. It took 2 months for that thing to heal.
It sure will. It sure does. But again, the ball players, they play hard. It's just they've got baseball, which I think we touched on this the last time a little bit. It's a tough game. You have to have some God-given ability. You can't play in the big leagues unless you have some God-given ability. If you don't have a very good arm, you never will. Your arm will never improve. I don't care where you, what position you play, it'll never improve. If you got a weak arm, it's always going to be weak. If you can't run, you get slower.
Mm-hmm.
As you get older and bigger and stronger, you'll get slower. If you're a 4-5 runner, at any time at all, you're 4-6 to first base. So when you take a ball player that can run, the real good runner, or he's got a real good arm, that's God-given ability. He had that ability the day he was born. Am I right? Yeah.
I guess so. I never got...
It's God-given ability. Now, you can improve a hitter, and you can improve fielding, but you're not going to improve much on an arm. I remember one time right out here at the complex when we had a turf infield.
Mm-hmm.
We'd put some turf on one of the diamonds just so they could learn to play a little bit on turf, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Luzeski was the left fielder. He was a young player. And he couldn't throw very good. He really couldn't. And neither could Lonnie Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And I told both of them, because I was an outfielder, and I said, here's what you have to do. And just recently, Ron Clark, now going to be the coach for the Cleveland Ball Club, last year was in Seattle, and before that with the White Sox. And he and I was having lunch, and he said, I always remember one thing you told me way back. Okay, I said, what's that? He said, you told me when I was a minor league manager to teach my outfielders to get the ball up in the air. Don't try to throw a line drive from the outfield because it won't go very good. Loft the ball up in the air and get some distance on it and then get some accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember telling him out here at Clearwater, Greg Luzinski, I said, Greg, we called him Bull. I said, get the ball up in the air. Get it up in the air, loft the ball, and hit on that astroturf, and it'll bounce to the catcher. But if you try to bounce that ball from third base to the catcher, it ain't going to get there very good. And Luzinski worked on it, and he really worked hard,
mm-hmm.
and became a credible outfielder because he could learn to loft the ball up in the air like this instead of line drive. And especially if you're playing on the grass, because that grass will stop it real quick on the line drive.
That's right.
Because you don't have any, there's no velocity on the ball.
Yeah.
So the God-given ability is there. I've run into, I don't know how many uncles, aunts, fathers, coaches, saying, I want you to take a look at my boy or my son or my grandson or something. He has the great desire. He loves baseball better than anything in the whole world. So I go see the ball player play as a favor to those people. And I see exactly what they're talking about because he does have great desire to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
But he had no ability.
Mm-hmm.
He had none. One of the great ball players that you and I touched a little bit on before we started this interview, or this taping, was Pete Rose.
Mm-hmm.
So we won't get into that he's banned from baseball.
That,
we won't get into that. Pete Rose did not have very good ability. I saw Pete Rose play when he first signed, when he played in the minor leagues, about the second or third year he played. Pete Rose couldn't run very good, never could run very good. He was below average runner, below average fielder. They played him at second base, they played him at third, they played him at first, they played him in the outfield. They tried every place in the world to play because he had the great desire. The one thing he could do, he could hit, and he had the great desire, and he made himself a ball player. He really did. But he's not the only one. Lou Boudreaux made himself a ball player because Lou Boudreaux couldn't throw very good from shortstop, and he couldn't run a lick, but Boudreaux could hit. He could hit.
So what you're saying, you got to have an arm, you got to be able to hit. Have you got those two?
When you find the perfect ball player, and you and I talked about this before when you were here, I know I'm not sure we taped it. When people say to me today, who's the best player you ever saw in almost 60 years of baseball? I said, there's about four. And I name them.
Mm-hmm.
Babe Ruth, Willie, not in this order, Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio, Willie Mays, Mickey Mantle.
Mm-hmm.
There's four.
Mm-hmm.
And you say to yourself, well, wait a minute. Now, what about Stan Musial? Or what about Ted Williams and those guys? You know, I said, these four people I'm talking about can beat you five ways. They can beat you throwing. They can beat you running. They can beat you fielding. They can beat you hitting. And they can beat you with a home run. And there's only four in my whole lifetime that could do that. Willie Mays couldn't. I mean, Ted Williams couldn't do that. Ted Williams could hit.
Yeah.
Stan Musial could hit. Yeah. Stan Musial had a very poor arm, you remember?
Yes.
Okay, so they don't come in that classification. And the guy that taught me that well over 50 years ago was Branch Rickey Sr. when he mentioned to me one time, which I never thought of when I first started scouting, the great ball player can beat you five ways. And I'm sitting there with him, and I'm trying to figure out, now, how can a ball player beat you five ways? And he explained it. Throwing the ball, fielding the ball, running, stealing bases, hitting, and home runs. And those great ball players, there's only four in my lifetime. There's only four. The other one that comes off is going to be awful close right now is Mike Schmidt. He's going to be awful close because he had a great arm.
Yeah.
And he could field the ball.
Rifle arm.
And he could, later on, he could hit and then hit the home run. But he only might be a 4-tool player because his speed wasn't real great.
Branch Rickey told you that 50 years ago.
Over 50 years ago. This is my 55th year to scout, and I'm sure he told me that about the second year I scouted, that the good ball player, the great ball player beat you five ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I will always remember that. And in my speeches and talking to scouts and things, the great ball player, he'll beat you five ways. And he will.
Mm-hmm. Let's take from that point then, as a scout, and they get up to go up the big leagues, play some minor league team on some minor league teams, where they got to learn some fundamentals. They got to take that ability and transform it, and into knowing more about the game. What manager or managers have you seen that have really taught the fundamentals of baseball to a bunch of guys that are making five times more money than they are? Probably feel like they don't really need to take orders from anybody, given that they can do three out of these five things that you just mentioned, but they don't really know what to do if the pitcher balked and they could get more than one base.
The first name that comes to my mind, and I can think of several before it's over.
Okay.
The one that comes to my mind real quick was Billy Martin.
Teaching the fundamentals.
Teaching fundamentals. He was great, absolutely great. He really was. He just and all of his players, wherever he managed, they all knew the fundamentals. Now you got to remember this. This is my personal opinion. Most of the good ball players are born with incentive. I mean, with the incentive to play the game of baseball.
Okay. Yeah. They got the motivation.
Plus the fact that they're born with. With the ability to know the fundamentals. They're absolutely born that way.
I see a lot of ball players throwing poor cutoffs,
that's
throws.
Right.
I
that's
see
right.
a lot
okay.
of
now, I'm not gonna run the
mindless base running. No, I'm not talking about running down any players, but I see a
but
lot of...
But if you go back to the Joe DiMaggio's and the Mickey Mantles, but I'm talking about a lot of players. I'm just picking those guys. I'm picking out the great stars. There was no coaching back in those days. Remember what I'm saying? There was no coaching. None. Back when I played.
No pitching coaches, no hitting coaches?
None. There was no coaches of any kind, special coaching.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of that was absolutely born in the ball player.
Well, they spent more time in the minor leagues learning that too, didn't they?
Absolutely. And even in high school and in semi-pro, there was always enough people around that knew a little bit about baseball. I remember that the first year I went to spring training, I was on first base, and somebody hit a ball, and when you turn second, you're supposed to turn your head and pick up that ball somewhere, wherever it is, and then, like Lonnie Smith did not do that in the World Series.
That's right.
He did not do that. He didn't pick up that ball. And stopped at third, remember? Okay,
yeah.
And that might have cost him the World Series. Okay, I'm not trying to run him down. And when I did that, I just hadn't quite turned 18 years old. when the game was over, Cy Slapnick, the guy that signed me, he said, "You really showed me something today." He said, you were born with instinct. You have to be born, because he said, "I saw you when you rounded first, a second. You looked to right center and picked up that ball real quick to see where that ball was."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Yeah, I did." And he said, "Did you do that on purpose?" I said, "No, I just somewhere where I was born with the deal, knowing that I had to pick up that ball." Nobody told me that, because they didn't have coaches back in my days, or the DiMaggio days, or the Stan Musial, or any of those ball players. Mm-hmm. They didn't have coaches. We got coaches coming out of our ears right now, and we're trying to, I guess, to force feed the young ball player on the fundamentals that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And it's not easy. It's not easy to do. I think a lot of it has to be a God-given talent.
Well, you know, let's take the Super Bowl, switching to football a moment. You know, I talked about the Redskins. And a lot of sports writers say, "Boy, what a dull team." But, boy, did they know the basics.
Did they know the fundamentals? Did they know them?
And you know what sports writers say? What a dull team.
Well, they it's tough to write, I guess, what they want to write.
So. Well, but they want to write about the hot dog.
Yeah, right.
And somebody doing an acrobat.
A quarterback, he knew every time who to throw that ball to, didn't he?
Yeah. But it was down there in the trenches. But we want to accent today.
Well, you know, you've been around a long time.
Yeah.
The good athlete, he'll beat you. The good athlete, he'll beat you. He'll figure out, he'll beat you.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I might have told you this story that Ted Lyons told me years ago, and Sloppy Thurston, those old guys with the White Sox.
Oh, yes.
About Babe Ruth. He was all, you know, they'd say, they'd be playing the Yankees, the White Sox. And Ted Lyons, he's in the Hall of Fame. And it would be, they'd get Babe Ruth out, like we're saying, the seventh inning, or maybe the top of the eighth, or whatever it might be. And then on the bench, they'd say, "Well, we got him beat today. We got him beat 3-2, or whatever the score was, because the Babe's not going to hit the rest of the game. He won't come up." And he said, invariably, I'd go out to the mound. Ted Lyons, the great pitcher, won 300-some ball game in the big league. And he said, I'd get wild, and I'd walk a couple of hitters, and the shortstop would boot a ball. And the first thing you know, in the ninth inning, here'd come the Babe. Out of the dugout, he's going to get the hit, and he didn't fail too many times.
That's right.
And that good hitter, for some reason, he'll appear up the bat in that late in that ball game, at eighth or ninth inning, he'll walk up there. And on the bench, we used to worry about that.
Yeah.
So and so, I hope he don't get the hit in the ninth inning.
Yeah.
Because you got to remember those guys, Hack Wilson and Babe Ruth, they go within 150 to 175, 190 runs a year.
Okay.
And if you get them up there at the bat.
The odds are in their favor.
It's in their favor. It sure is. It sure is. They might say, well, a 300 hitter only gets 3 hits out of 10 times a bat. But those guys, for some reason, they could prevail.
Hugh, we spent a lot of time